Welcome to the Jihadology Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Aaron Zellin, founder of Jihadology.net.
And I'm Carl Morand, the show's producer. On this episode, we're going to be covering some primary source releases over the past few weeks. The main topics we're going to be hitting are anti-Islamic State messages, Islamic State state-building efforts, the Caliphate anniversary, the martyrdom of Nasir al-Wuhayshi, and an update to the spy games topic that we touched on a couple weeks ago.
After that, we'll have my conversation with Nelly Lahoud about the connection between the anti-crusader leader and military commander Nur ad-Din al-Zinki and Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, and how that's then linked to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's public speech we saw a year ago in Mosul. Also, we'll look at a five-year retrospective on her book, The Jihadi's Path to Self-Destruction, and conclude by discussing her forthcoming research on the original leader of the Islamic State from 2006 to 2010, Abu Umar al-Baghdadi. Nelly is the associate professor at the Department of Social Sciences at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point and a senior associate at the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point. She's author of the 2010 book, The Jihadi's Path to Self-Destruction, a must-read for anyone interested in the intellectual history of jihadi thought. In this podcast, we're going to add a new section called hashtag social media. In it, I select a few different things that I found interesting from different social media posts from a variety of different jihadi groups and actors over the past few weeks. And this will hopefully be a continued feature within the podcast, whether it's just when it's in a standalone interviewed podcast or one with the full primary source explanations too.
So to start out with primary sources, what's recently been going on as far as anti-Islamic State messaging?
One of the first things we saw since our last podcast was that there is a fatwa signed by some of the big weights that are pro-Al-Qaeda, that are independent jihadi scholars, such as Abu Qatada al-Filistini, Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi, Sami al-Uraidi, who's the top Sharia official in Jabhat al-Nusra, Abu Suleiman al-Australi, an Australian guy who's also a Sharia official in Jabhat al-Nusra, and Dr. Abdullah al-Muhaisini, a preacher who's based in northern Syria doing a lot of dawah activities. In this, it was primarily it was a fatwa in response to some people asking about what sort of the Mujahideen should do in light of ISIS's incursions into the region of Sauran, which is north of Aleppo. They're wondering what should be done, whether individuals should fight them, whether they should try and seek reconciliation. And in this fatwa, it was declared that it was permissible to fight the Islamic State and to resist ceding any territory to them. This is a continuation in many ways of many of the anti-ISIS messaging we've seen from many of these different clerics over the past year or so. But this was the first overt one where they really came together and overtly said that it's legitimate to fight them. And it's likely that this could then translate into analogous potential situations in the future too, since they have the heavyweight hand behind it for those who are in Jabhat al-Nusra or other smaller independent type of jihadi organizations such as Jabhat Ansar al-Din or Jund al-Aqsa or even Jabhat al-Nusra's friends in Ahrar al-Sham. Moving from Syrian context to Libya, we also saw an interesting statement from Majlis Shura al-Mujahideen in Darna City. This is compromised with Ansar al-Sharia in Libya, as well as the Abu Salim Martyrs Brigade and some other factions. And most recently, for those who have been paying attention to the news, the Islamic State was kicked out of Darna City. And ahead of this, on June 10th, Majlis Shura al-Mujahideen released a statement about clashes and highlighting how the Islamic State were Kharijites, as we've seen many people who are opposed to them call them, and therefore legitimizing, declaring a jihad against them, in part because they described how the Islamic State was killing innocent Muslims and Mujahideen in Darna City and that despite giving them sort of opportunities to repent their actions, they continue to do so. And as a result, we saw what happened where the Islamic State was fought against and they're kicked out of Darna City, though they are still residing in some of the smaller villages in the countryside of that region. About a week later, we then saw a statement from the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, or better known, you know, publicly as the Taliban in the West. And they released a statement directly towards Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of the Islamic State, in part because we've seen the Islamic State have an incursion into the AFPAC region in the past couple of months. But in the past few weeks in particular, we've seen them ramping up their activities, whether it's actually doing Dawah activities, but also executing individuals, including some leaders within the Taliban. One of the things that this statement was discussing was how the fitna of in Afghanistan in the 1980s against the Soviets really hurt the jihad then, and is, they believe, many ways why things took so long for that the Soviets to leave, and therefore unity was needed, and that you know, the jihad against the United States and NATO should only be fought under one single banner, and that, you know, what they have shown over the past decade or so fighting the United States is that they've given the U.S. so-called unforgettable defeats, and therefore bringing somebody in to cause fitna, such as what they believe the Islamic State is doing, could really hurt these efforts and only benefit the United States and NATO then. And therefore, they're calling for the Islamic State to assist the Taliban and support them and keep this unity, and that they shouldn't be trying to control the events of Afghanistan from far away. Another message that we saw was from Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi himself on June 23rd, where he was explaining why he himself hasn't called the Islamic State Kharijites yet. Part of this is he doesn't believe many in the rank and file of the Islamic State truly understand what they're doing. And he himself considers the leaders of the Islamic State to be the true evil here. But because these innocent individuals that are foot soldiers, essentially, have gone astray, it would be unfair to use this characterization because they could potentially be brought back into the fold. Additionally, Maqdisi believes that people should be cautious about how they use such labels, because then it could be distorted potentially by enemies of Islam or foreign agendas. And he also takes pains in many ways to point out the fact that while he hasn't labeled them Kharijites, he doesn't accept them at all or considers them credible. And then he concludes by discussing a bit about some of the issues that he had when there was negotiations over the Jordanian pilot who had been captured prior to his execution by burning. And the final statement that goes against the Islamic State that we saw over the last 3.5 weeks or so was a piece put out by AQIM's Abu Ahmed Abdul Karim al-Jazairi. And it's essentially a rebuttal to a letter that was written by Abu Abdullah al-Libi, who had previously been the top Sharia official in Ansar al-Sharia based in Benghazi, who had later then pledged bayat to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. And essentially, he first starts off by saying that, you know, as we've heard in many of these arguments before this week and in the previous podcast, how this caliphate isn't legitimate. And he notes that even if it is necessary, it doesn't have the support of the scholars. He argues that and in a unique way that the criticisms that Abu Abdullah al-Libi had against those who hadn't pledged bayah yet were sort of anachronistic. When Libi argues that not all the ummah has to agree on the caliphate, al-Jazairi retorted that this argument was formulated by Ibn Hazm, who's from the medieval period, and that the development of the internet, for example, makes it reasonable to expect more extensive consultation amongst broader swath of individuals and scholars and important notables within society. And essentially, al-Jazairi is calling al-Libi out for not truly understanding the Sharia texts and scholarly opinions, and therefore doesn't have sort of legitimacy and providing arguments for those for joining up with the Islamic State, and that he needs to go back to school, more or less.
All right. And what has come out over the past couple weeks regarding the Islamic State and their state-building efforts?
We've seen a number of releases over the past few weeks from the Islamic State, from their different press offices, about a variety of activities that they're trying to promote within the territory that they control, as well as a way to show, you know, a broader demographic or outside audience, or potentially people that they hope to come to the Islamic State, that they are, you know, running a state. One of the first releases that they had in this period was about a zakat office that they had in Raqqa, and how it was trying to help support different refugees and distributing food and money to the poor and needy. They also highlighted how they're meeting with a bunch of local traders to determine zakat contributions and outline the Sharia rules for it, in part because they wanted to educate the local populace about this. They also discussed a little bit the Office of Public Works and how they're involved in upgrading the roads and electricity in Al-Raqqa, as well as highlighting the different Islamic courts that were functioning, as well as the offices of Dawah and mosques. For example, they're highlighting how in Wilayat Dijla, which is in Iraq, is planning the construction of a number of new mosques. On the same day as that particular release, the Islamic State also put out a video from Wilayat al-Jazira, which is a province that straddles both the Syrian and Iraqi borders, called the Abdullah bin Umar Institute. And it was essentially a Sharia institute for children. In it, they interview a teacher named Abu Musawiya, and who speaks about the role of Sharia institutes as for training, you know, the soldiers of the caliphate, as he describes it. And it teaches a number of grades for young boys and youths, with courses focusing on Quranic memorization, recitation. And then there's footage of these lessons. For example, they showed people studying Aqidah or Islamic creed, as well as the Quranic recitation or tajweed. Later, this same teacher then explains how the institute trains students physically and militarily, as well as in the manners of religion and learning. And then the video ended sort of showing these children parading through the streets of Tal Afar at the end of it. A few days later, in Wilayat al-Khair, which is a name that the Islamic State uses for the Deir ez-Zor region in the northeastern part of Syria, primarily desert region, about the medical care that they're providing. In it, it interviews a few different doctors within the practices that they're doing. One of them is a British Sudanese ISIS member, and he describes the different health services as good, and mentioning especially the pediatric hospitals that they do, as well as the medical imaging and tests that they conduct, and the orthopedic surgery and trauma surgery that they're doing, in addition to the emergency department, where they get the bulk of their admissions, in part because of the Syrian regime's bombing of civilians. And then they showed different ambulances at work bringing people there, as well as sort of a blood donation campaign to help out these people when they come in, as well as highlighting the intensive care unit and how they're Islamic State has regulations for pharmacies and hygiene, the medical imagery, and the medical school that they run. And this British Sudanese member of ISIS then at the end calls for more people from Sudan as well as Britain to join up, especially those that are specialized doctors. On June 17th, we got a reporters program from the Islamic State's Idhat al-Bayan radio station, which is based in Mosul, talking about the different affairs in the cities of Tadmor and al-Sukhna. Tadmor, many know by more Palmyra in English. And they interview one of their fighters there, Abu al-Maji al-Muhajir. And they're describing sort of what they've done in this area of Syria since they took over, and how they're working to rebuild the destruction caused by the Assad and repairing a bunch of different things, as well as undertaking other infrastructure projects. If you triangulate this message with social media that the Islamic State's released over this 3.5-week period from June 1st to June 24th, in particular, in Tadmor, the Islamic State promoted how they're repainting buildings there, fixing electrical lines, clearing roads that had rubble previously. They showed a souk or a market running again. They're highlighting a bread factory where they're making a bunch of bread for the local population, as well as the different stores of wheat that they had, likely brought over from different areas of the territory that they controlled. And then, as you know, continuing the theme from earlier, in their state building, and what they've been doing is showing them providing zakat to the poor and needy on June 22nd. And then the last video that they released in this time period related to state building was another one related to the issue of zakat. And in it, they had ISIS members explaining what zakat was to locals and highlighting the different religious offices established by the Islamic State. They're also preparing different leaflets and other informational material about zakat and distributing it to inhabitants and touring shops, reminding people of their obligation to pay this. And then there are some ISIS activists talking about the importance of charity and helping the poor, as well as then explaining the different rates due on different commodities such as precious metals, livestock, and other types of things. And then to highlight how, you know, the Islamic State is a state and has sort of this bureaucracy, he was interviewing an individual, and a part of it, he was highlighting how even when you pay the zakat, the Islamic State will give you a special badge to sort of certify that you have paid, to show that they're keeping records and that this isn't just willy-nilly in many respects.
And recently we had the 1-year anniversary of the declaration of the caliphate. What's been coming out relating to that event and the anniversary as it passes?
Yeah, exactly. We saw some 3 videos coming out in this time period leading up to the anniversary of the 1 year of the caliphate announcement from the Islamic State. The first one was on June 11th from Wilayat Nineveh in Iraq. And it shows footage of the Islamic State training camps in Iraq in preparation for the invasion of Mosul a year ago. And then, you know, subsequently what happened after that, them being welcomed by the local inhabitants, then them freeing prisoners. And then they highlighted specific things that they had been doing in Mosul since coming to power. In particular, they are showing the destruction of churches and artifacts in the Mosul Museum, as well as the murder of those accused of homosexual acts by throwing them from buildings, as well as hand amputations for theft. In another video, about a week later after that, came out from Wilayat Sinai in Egypt. This one, there are members of the Islamic State sitting in a tent speaking about the anniversary and remembering those who had died for the caliphate in the previous year, and addressing those who had not yet joined the jihad and urged them to stand up and join their ranks, as well as urging the so-called hypocrites to repent. Whereas the third video message that they put out came from Wilayat Sana'a in Yemen on June 21st. In the beginning of it showed what appeared to be medieval crusaders fighting with the soldiers of the caliphate, hearkening back to prior battles, and then recounting the story of the origins of Islam and, from their interpretation, how it relied on jihad to spread and become established in the first place, essentially trying to make a parallel between what happened hundreds of years ago with what the Islamic State is attempting to do now, or reaccomplish, or follow in the footsteps, if you will. And then highlighting how the Islamic State has united against all the enemies and infidels under the flag of Tawhid, or monotheism, and they're criticizing the so-called Islamic groups who fight against the Islamic State, possibly in the context, since this is a video from Yemen, of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And then just highlighting how the establishment of the caliphate was good news for Muslims because it promised them to be defended and that the Sharia would be enforced now.
Another topic that's been in the news recently is the death of Nasser al-Muhaishi, who was killed in a drone strike a couple weeks ago in the beginning of June. What's been coming out in the primary sources world regarding that incident, his death?
Well, one of the interesting things, what happens when there's a leader of the magnitude of Nasser al-Muhaishi, also known as Abu Basir, AQAP's leader and the general manager of AQ's broader network in general, is that you see an outpouring of different martyrdom notices from a variety of groups. And what I've noticed over the years is that it's a very good way of seeing which groups are sort of aligned with Al-Qaeda or sympathetic to them versus those that maybe aren't. And I think it's relevant, especially now that there is this broader competition between Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. And I thought it would be interesting just to highlight specifically which groups put out these statements. Not necessarily the content, since they're all relatively the same in terms of the usual rhetoric related to how, you know, he was such a great martyr and doing great jihadi work, and now, you know, he was in paradise and the like. And we saw different messages from the Caucasus Emirate, Ansar al-Furqan, which is a group in Iran, Al-Shabaab in Somalia, Ansar al-Islam, which originally is from Iraq, but now is more or less just in Syria now, Jabhat Ansar al-Din, which is a smaller jihadi umbrella faction in Syria, the Global Islamic Media Front, which is just a media outlet that's been involved in assisting Al-Qaeda going back at least a decade now, the Abdullah Azzam Brigades in Lebanon, Jaish al-Ummah in Gaza, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, Jund al-Aqsa, which is another independent, smaller jihadi faction in northern Syria, and Jabhat al-Nusra. It was surprising, though, that we didn't see anything from Ansar al-Sharia in Libya or Ajnad Misr, since in the past they have provided martyrdom notices for other Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula leaders. It's quite possible that, you know, in the case of Ajnad Misr, they might not be operating really much anymore, since they haven't posted anything themselves in quite some time. And then as for ASL, it's hard to say. Maybe they're just busy with a variety of other things.
All right. And finally, can you give us an update to the spy games topic we talked about a couple weeks ago?
Yeah. So as I noted a few weeks ago, AQAP had caught this individual named Humam al-Hamid, who'd been in charge of Al-Husam Media, one of the media wings of AQAP. Since then, the podcast came out on June 17th, AQAP actually crucified him, along with summarily executing two other spies. And one of the things that I mentioned in the previous podcast is that Al-Husam was going to be renaming itself and sort of rebranding in many ways. And we finally saw this on June 24th when the Al-Husam account put out a statement and message about this new Twitter account and new media outlet called Al-Hikma Media Foundation. And it was encouraging people to support this account. But interestingly enough, with Al-Husam previously, a lot of it was mainly ideological content. A lot of it was anti-Saudi, whereas over the past few days or so since Al-Hikma was established, it's not only posting content from AQAP, but it's reposting content from other AQ branches as well, such as AQIM or even Jabhat al-Nusra in Syria. So we'll see. It hasn't put any original content out yet, but we'll see what comes from it soon.
All right. And now here's Aaron's interview with Nelly Lahoud.
Thanks for coming onto the show, Nelly. It's great to have you, and I hope you're well after the conference in Oslo that we were at this past week.
It's my pleasure. Yes, it was delightful to see you at the conference, and it was great to be present and to learn from everybody who was there. It was a fantastic conference, and I feel that I know much more about the group that calls itself the Islamic State than I did before I went there.
Yeah, that's a perfect setup to the first question that I have about some of the work that you've done. You at the conference, you presented a paper based off of the paper you wrote for the CTC West Point last December called "The Group That Calls Itself a State." And there was one part about it that I thought was really interesting and brings in historical aspects, but also relevant to now in terms of things that happened hundreds of years ago, but even stuff related to a decade ago. And in particular, you're talking about Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the original leader of the Islamic State, which was then called Jamaat al-Tawhid wal-Jihad, and then later popularly Al-Qaeda in Iraq and the Islamic State of Iraq, and his fascination with Nur ad-Din az-Zingi, and how that relates to the city of Mosul, and then how that might relate then to what we've seen last year in July when Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi had his speech following the caliphate announcement. So I was just wondering if you could first provide maybe a little context on who Nur ad-Din az-Zingi is in Islamic history, and then also why he's so relevant to Zarqawi and then later to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
Well, that is actually a very interesting figure, and I have to acknowledge that it is al-Zarqawi who actually introduced me to Nur ad-Din az-Zingi. I didn't know about him before. But to be more precise, actually, it's actually Saif al-Adl who is writing about Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's fascination with the military commander Nur ad-Din az-Zingi. He seems to have been very interested in him, and he would ask people around to collect any kind of writings about Nur ad-Din az-Zingi. That's what Saif al-Adl's account of al-Zarqawi. And so that obviously intrigued me. And Saif also remarks that it was Nur ad-Din who actually started the military campaign that would later be completed by Salah ad-Din, Saladin, which is the liberation of the Holy Land from the Crusaders. So it turned out that he was a military commander, and he died in 1174. And really, Mosul was the place where he launched that campaign. So that really, up till that point, I was intrigued. But as we all know, that Zarqawi, although he managed to make it into Iraq after the fall of Afghanistan, he did not really get to Mosul. But it was interesting that when Abu Bakr's first public appearance, his debut, it came out and it was in the Grand Mosque, the Grand Mosque in Mosul, that was built by none other than Nur ad-Din az-Zingi. Now, maybe I am stretching it, but I do believe that at least there's good justification for me to make the stretch, and I believe that this may well have been Abu Bakr's homage, if you like, to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, in the sense that he is completing what the founder of the group had actually started.
Yeah, definitely. So, I don't know if you would compare Abu Bakr then to Nur ad-Din az-Zingi, and maybe his successor as Saladin, or maybe Zarqawi would be Nur ad-Din az-Zingi, and Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi would be Nur ad-Din az-Zingi. But it'll definitely be interesting to see how these continued military campaigns go in the region.
For the record, you are the one who made the comparison. <not me.
laughs> No, I'm just thinking off the top of my head. So
yeah, I don't know. There is.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know what's going to happen.
Sure, I mean, there is.
It would be quite shocking too if we all of a sudden saw, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi or whoever might come after him if he's killed, you know, taking over Jerusalem or something. That would, you know, obviously the announcement of the caliphate was shocking for many people, but that would be even more so.
Sure. Yes. No. I think Abu Bakr would be very pleased yeah. with you to have made that comparison. But I think he wishes. But anyway. But look, I think having said that, this isn't to belittle what Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi did.
Sure.
I mean, to start with, I think we should pay attention or not forget that that group hasn't celebrated its 1 year anniversary yet.
True.
But second, even though it hasn't celebrated its 1 year anniversary, it has nevertheless made some unexpected achievements that has surprised many, the international community, the policy community, and possibly it may have surprised them as well. So,
yeah,
but you know, this isn't to undermine what they did in relation to the way we observe the jihadi landscape.
Of course, of course. Now, stepping back a little bit, a few years, you wrote a book called "The Jihadi's Path to Self-Destruction" in 2010. And I actually wrote a review of it for the academic journal Terrorism and Political Violence. And one of my concluding statements in it, I said, was the likelihood of internal fitna between global jihadis is the biggest takeaway from Lahoud's work. Maybe I was ahead of myself or that I just got a good idea from reading your book, but it seems ever more present since 2010, especially since April 2013, that this movement has really had a crater in it in some ways between Al-Qaeda's vision of this jihadi movement and then now the Islamic State's vision of it.
Yes, thank you kindly for mentioning the book and for reviewing the book, which you kindly wrote a great review of it. You know, there is a French saying that goes, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose, which roughly translates to the more things appear to be changing, the more mm-hmm. they are the same.
Yeah.
So I think in many respects, this trend had started a long time ago. It had started in Afghanistan. You know, we know, for example, that some of key leaders of Al-Qaeda, Abu Hafs al-Musri and Abu Ubaida al-Banshiri, there were assassination attempts against them by some people in Afghanistan mm-hmm. who didn't think that they were Islamic enough. There were also reports that I think Bin Laden in Sudan, there was
yeah.
an assassination
yeah.
attempt against him as well. Again, by people who didn't think that he was Islamic enough. So this has started a long time ago. When I was writing the book, you know, and at the time, you know, I wanna say what I think was present in the book and also what was not present in the book. When I was writing the book, I was looking at jihadi ideology and I was really focusing on reading ideological texts. I was not looking at organizations. I was interested in the various ideological treatises that are published by online and are available to everyone, but I focused on the Arabic stuff. And at the time, it was very clear to me that the group that was headed by Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi was really the bête noire of Al-Qaeda, precisely because of the rigidity, the religious rigidity of Zarqawi, which was very obvious to Bin Laden and to Ayman al-Zawahiri as early as 1999. And that I actually wrote in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very clear that trend that Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi had started, that rigidity, is very different from the pragmatic approach that Al-Qaeda had intended for the jihadi, for jihadism broadly. Now, obviously, Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi has reneged and and keeps saying that it's not really not him. It's the others who misunderstand him. But it was obvious then that this was really not going to go down very well. It was just a question of time. So what I wasn't studying at the time when I was writing the book, I wasn't studying Al-Qaeda as an organization. And that I have done some work since the book, particularly Beware of Imitators, which is a study of Fadl Haroun, an operative of Al-Qaeda. It's 1,156 pages, his autobiography. But it is, I believe, I think it's the richest source that we've got of Al-Qaeda. And it was really my education of Al-Qaeda, and it taught me not just how to look at groups like Al-Qaeda through the lens of ideological text, but also through the lens of operatives who can actually tell you how ideology is consumed, what matters and what does not matter, the extent to which pragmatism is really applied by Al-Qaeda's leadership and the various operatives, the hierarchy of the organization, the meritocracy that it relied upon. So, and of course, when I worked on the documents that were declassified from Bin Laden's compound, it also shed additional light for me in terms of the kind of separation between the world of Al-Qaeda and the world of other regional jihadi groups. And this really highlighted to me that we're not looking at a monolithic movement or at Al-Qaeda central, as some have described it, that this really did not exist. So from that perspective, I've learned quite a lot since the book about the organizational dimension of Al-Qaeda in relation to other groups. And I think had I done that at the time, I think I would have probably been more alert to the statements that were coming out in 2006 from the leadership of the Iraq-based group, and even maybe 2005, in terms of the kind of divorce that was taking place at the time. In hindsight, I see it. I knew that there were differences, but I think it was there for us to see. But we were not paying that kind of attention at the time. I certainly was not paying attention, and I think for a very, very long time, and up until really recently, many people continued to refer to that group as Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Which,
yeah, exactly. Even though they hadn't used the name itself since 2006.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Moving on from more of the AQ and IS type of aspects of the intellectual debates, one of the things that is interesting that you're writing about was the evolution from Islamism in general, the broader big umbrella of it, and jihadism, and how you're talking how Islamism was more of a communal orientation and it was emphasizing religious education and training, while the jihadists were more individualistic and they're zealously only focusing on jihad. In the past few years, though, we've obviously seen jihadis in a number of locations, but in particular Syria, doing governance activities as well as dawah activities where they're training and educating people as well. Would you say that this is just a change within the jihadi movement and it's co-opting aspects of what Islamism is? Or would you still argue that jihadis are still more individualistic in some ways, and that even though they are doing these types of governance and dawah activities more now than they had in the past, in addition to obviously the insurgent activities?
Yes and no. Let me first clarify what I defined as Islamism and the way in which I defined it. I think I argue in the book, and I continue to do so, that jihadism represents a rupture from Islamism, because Islamism, it's not just a question of being interested in governance. Islamism, since the time of, if you want to consider Hassan al-Banna as the proto-Islamist, if you like, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood since 1928, it has accepted the nation state. It has accepted the political processes of the nation states. They are happy to organize themselves into political groups, contest elections, deal with governments, etc. Jihadism has really, from its start, has considered all these processes to be unlawful. So yes, both would probably use Islam as the kind of the ideological foundation or the ideological creed on the basis, like they consider Islam or Islamic teachings to serve as the creed of both jihadis and Islamist groups. But I think the jihadis have never accepted the nation state as lawful. They've not accepted that international law, as well as, you know, none of the states are considered to be lawful in their own minds. And in doing so, they developed this individualistic understanding, particularly of jihad, which, and I think it was very smart on their part to do that, because this really allowed them to allow jihadis to resort to jihad on an individual basis, which means that because when you accept the nation state, you have to accept that the state has the monopoly on the use of violence, which that's obviously not in the interest of the jihadis. So that's why they became individualistic. Now, where I have changed my mind is really the fact that maybe we are now seeing a rupture within jihadism, mm-hmm. We are seeing this interest in statehood.
Yeah.
In the times of Al-Qaeda, of course, you know, they would say that we want to establish the Islamic State and so on and so forth. But there was no plan and no desire to focus on that. They saw themselves, as Fadil Harun would put it, as, you know, the jihadis without borders. They wanted to bring down the establishments. They didn't want to build establishments, and for good reasons. They thought themselves, they had a very plausible and attractive narrative that was anti-establishment, that managed to, put advance very solid critique of the various states, as well as the international order, as well as human rights as applied in the world, and the injustices of the global system. Mm-hmm. So they were not really in the business at all of, building a state. Like one of the letters that Bin Laden authored that was captured in Abu Tabad and was declassified, there is a letter from Al-Wuhayshi to him asking him, shall we declare an Islamic state in Yemen? And the letter goes on saying that, you know, of course we'd love to declare an Islamic state, but only if we could keep it. And despite all the problems that we have caused the Americans, in no time they would actually destroy such a state were we to declare it. So they were not interested in doing that. Now, despite the ideological and doctrinal disagreements between the Iraq-based group and Al-Qaeda, I think now we are seeing a rupture in terms of translating that desire into a state and wanting to engage in governance. So this is something it was on the minds of Abu Umar al-Baghdadi when he declared the state in 2006, but this is something different from other types of jihadism that we've been used to, and I wonder whether we are really witnessing another kind of rupture at the moment.
Interesting. That you would say is even different than what Zarqawi was doing?
Well, Zarqawi didn't have the chance.
Yeah, I mean, he was
to do
killed.
It. I mean, right.
Ahead of, before they even announced ISI.
Right. Would he have wanted to? It sounds, you know, from based on what we read about him, that's what he had in mind. So yes, it was on their mind, but now I think, you know, up to a certain point, we still thought of that, you know, the jihadi landscape as driven by the doctrine of defensive jihad, which meant that jihad is farad ayn, it is the individual obligation of every Muslim. But there was no agenda to build a state, or to use it towards building a state. Now I think this is certainly changing. I don't know whether it's changing or the success has actually really forced us to see it in a different light. But certainly the jihadism of building statehood is not the same as the jihadism of Al-Qaeda, of the jihadis without borders sort of jihadism.
Yeah, it's because you do see some Al-Qaeda groups or branches, however you want to describe them, doing some governance. They're not claiming themselves as an emirate or state, though, such
sure.
as Jabhat al-Nusra and even AQAP. And if you accept the fact that Ansar al-Sharia in Libya is probably an AQ branch, even though they don't say it publicly, but you do see them doing it, but it's more inclusive, or they're not saying that they are the sovereign, and they're
right.
willing to work with local actors, notables, and other rebel or insurgent factions, whereas the Islamic State, of course, says that, you know, we are the sovereign power, you must pledge bayat to the caliph.
Right. And Jabhat al-Nusra has gone like back and forth on that several times.
Yeah.
And most recently, it seems they're not an imara. At a certain point, they were flirting with that possibility. So, you know, there's a bit of thinking and flirting with that possibility, but they certainly, as you rightly pointed out, they are not committing themselves to that. But even if they were to commit to Imara is very different from a state.
Yeah, of course. So the last thing I wanted to touch upon, which you were discussing a little bit when we were talking in Oslo last week, is the project that you're currently working on about Abu Umar al-Baghdadi, who is the predecessor to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. And Abu Umar himself, you know, many people haven't really focused on him at all. It's usually people talking about Zarqawi and then Abu Bakr. So I was just curious if you'd be happy to share at least some of the preliminary ideas that you've come across or are thinking about right now, since obviously it's a work in progress and you haven't published it yet, but it might be an interesting preview to the listeners.
Sure, provided that the listeners also know that I may change my mind about the things that I'm about to say. But yes, he intrigues me because he is the one who actually declared the state, and that must have been a big deal at the time. The declaration of the state in 2006 really upset the leadership of Al-Qaeda, and that was certainly a coup, if you like, practically a divorce. This ultimately says that we are a state, we are no longer part of a group, and the group has to be lower than a state. It has to be, we can no longer, once you declare yourself a state, you can no longer be subordinate to a group. It should be the other way around. So that was done in 2006 and under the leadership of Abu Umar al-Baghdadi. That's why I'm really interested in going back through all his statements. And then I want to also look at the Abu Hamza al-Muhajir statements and so on. Now, you know, your listeners also obviously know that at the time when they succeeded al-Zarqawi, there was discussion as to whether the man himself exists and so on.
Yeah.
I mean, he may well be a fictitious character, but I am I am relying on the statements, and the statements exist. So that's the study. So whether people are going to tell me, oh, he was a nobody, or he doesn't exist, or that was not him.
Somebody is still putting it out.
I am interested in the vision behind these statements.
Yeah.
And I also, just also before I start talking about his work, I'm also intrigued by that transition, if you like, from Al-Qaeda fi bilad al-Rafidain, or Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, which is the name that Zarqawi's group got after bin Laden accepted them into the fold, mm-hmm. and the various name changes that occurred after that. And you remember that they became Majlis Shura al-Mujahideen at some point.
Yeah.
And then the name changed yet again. For a short period, it was Helf al-Mutayyabin. I refer to this because when Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi in 2013 announced the merger with Al-Nusra, which, you know, they decided not to accept 2 days later, he did mention the various names that they went through, but he skipped Helf al-Mutayyabin. So I don't know what that means. And that also intrigues me. Why was that name did not, surely he must have the record, so it couldn't have really escaped him. So what was happening in that time, the groups that really made out that, that Majlis Shura al-Mujahideen consisted of many groups, what were they really like at the time, and to what extent were they a liability to Abu Umar al-Baghdadi or not? Having said that, the statements that I have covered so far, to start with, he was very clear right from the beginning that that he was the leader of a state,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, made all the kind of Arabic references, the humble references, Al Abd al Faqir, etc.
Yeah.
That I am, you know, but he saw himself as Amir al Mu'mineen, the leader of the faithful, and also in the first or the second statement, he's referring to a report that was published by Rand, in which, you know, they're highlighting that maybe Al-Qaeda in Iraq is really still a threat to the U.S. forces over there. And he went on to say, but Al-Qaeda in Iraq is not, but Al-Qaeda is but a group of the groups that make up the Islamic State. That was really early on. And in December 2007, he made it clear that Al-Qaeda has been dissolved once Abu Hamza pledged the allegiance. So he effectively put an end to Al-Qaeda. The other things that I have noted, and I think they're worth paying attention to, he did outreach, for example, to the Kurds. He saw them as being, he used very praiseworthy language of, about their heroism in history, and inviting them to be part of that Islamic state that was declared. He also did an outreach to the Ba'athists. He was very explicit about that in his early statements, calling on the Ba'athists to join the state so long as they memorize some verses from the Quran, etc. So he wasn't really being tough in terms of his request. And he also, I don't know whether appealed to the Shiites is the right description, but he also called on the Shiites to, you know, wake up to the sort of infidelity that they have to their shirk, and to realize that they are not part of the proper religion, and so on. So he tried to do outreach, but he also tried to do outreach within all these groups initially that made up that Islamic State. But soon thereafter, you start seeing his concern about some of the groups And I think, you know, so far, you know, we know, for example, that Ansar al-Sunnah, they were not always compliant with his wishes. We know al-Jaysh al-Iraq al-Islami, the Islamic, I think it's the Islamic Army of Iraq, I think.
Yeah.
You know, they also major problems between the two. Thawrat Ashreen, the group Thawrat Ashreen, most likely former Ba'athist. It's like he comes, you know, he uses that group quite a lot in his speeches. It sounds as if it was his own bête noire. So, I think we need to look more at that history or that phase in the history of that group in order to appreciate what is happening at the moment, what are the strengths and what are the weaknesses. And we also have some material that were captured battlefield documents that are now available publicly, including some that are highly critical of the group and highly critical of the fact that they declared themselves a state at the time. So I think there's room for us to understand the group a little bit better once we get its history in order.
Yeah, I definitely would agree with that, especially since starting with the Sahwa movement and the surge and, you know, the perception that they were declining and not doing as well. Many people stopped focusing on them as much and focused back on Afghanistan or on Yemen, for example, when AQAP started to really come onto the scene also around that time. So hopefully this work, you know, will fill a major gap in our understanding of the history of the Islamic State and all of its prior incarnations in terms of the different names it's had over time.
I hope so too. Yes, thank you.
Well, I think besides myself looking forward to it, I imagine that the listeners will as well. So I just wanted to thank you for coming on to the Jihadology podcast, and I'll see you soon.
It was a pleasure, Aaron. Thank you. And thank you for all the great work that you do for the field.
Thank you very much. In June, we've seen more than 35 foreign fighters announced killed in Iraq and Syria each. Additionally, AQAP has conducted 49 military operations in Yemen. The Islamic State has had end-of-the-year tests for students in Wilayat al-Fallujah, Wilayat Furat, Wilayat al-Raqqa, Wilayat al-Jazeera, and Wilayat al-Anbar. On June 4th, the administrator of Ifriqiya Media was arrested in Tunisia. On June 9th, in Wilayat al-Raqqa, the Islamic State had an anti-leishmaniasis campaign, which is a disease spread by the bite of certain types of sandflies. On June 18th, for the first time, Jabhat al-Nusra released documents about a harvest it was doing in Hama. On June 20th, the Islamic State's Wilayat Khorasan in Afghanistan had its first ever Dawah event in the Kot district of Nangarhar province. On June 21st, in Mosul, as part of Wilayat Nineveh, the Islamic State completed the building of the Sheikh Abu Umar al-Baghdadi Mosque, who was the original leader of the Islamic State from 2006 to 2010. On June 25th, in Gaza, Liwa al-Tawheed, which is a part of the Nasser Salah al-Din Brigades, had a graduation ceremony for a military camp. On June 27th, in Wilayat al-Raqqa, the Islamic State had an anti-mosquito campaign where they sprayed pesticides in the streets and neighborhoods. And on June 28th, Jaysh al-Umma, a Gaza-based jihadist group, called for donations for different types of weapons on Twitter. These different types of weapons were ranging all the way from $200 to $9,500, and they provided a different account where people can get in contact with them. Hashtag social media. Thanks everyone for listening to the Jihadology podcast. Thank you to Nelly for coming onto the show and sharing her expertise with us. Also, thanks to the Podmaster Carl Moran for making sure this podcast sounds and runs smoothly, and to Elsbeth Carruthers for helping with background research on the primary source material. Until next time, I'm out.